Get Back, take 19. One of many captured in Peter Jackson's documentary of the same name of the Beatles in 1969, except, of course, it's not Sir Peter Jackson's documentary, only Sir Michael Lindsay Hogg was a pioneer in music, film production, directing projects for the Rolling Stones, Neil Young, Simon and Garfunkel, and the Beatles. The subject of his once long-lost, now possibly most famous work, the documentary Let It Be. And the footage he shot has been technologically enhanced into Get Back, the 7 or 8 hour epic of Sir Peter Jackson, 56 hours of footage he inherited from Sir Michael, who joins me now. Hello, how are you?
Kim, I'm great. But what's surprising is in the Get Back take you just played, you didn't play the one we did on the roof when Paul McCartney sings, "Get back, your mother's getting annoyed. She's going to have you arrested," which is what was happening on the roof, which was the take when the police were up there. But choice is choice. I mean, that was a very good one that you played.
We had so much to choose from. How did you whittle down your 56 hours of footage into whatever it was, 90 minutes of Let It Be?
Well, I had, you don't forget, we're talking 50 years ago, and I had a different size canvas than Peter did. Peter had a eight-hour canvas, and I had a 80 or 90-minute canvas, which was just what seemed seemly at the point. It's a really long story, which you probably know, about Let It Be was originally going to be a television special, then it turned into a documentary, then it didn't have an ending, then I thought of the roof, then we went up on the roof. And I, do you want me to do my rap about it now, which will take a minute or two? Or
yeah, no, go for it.
Go for it, okay. We shot Let It Be in January 1969, right at the beginning of the new year. We edited it through the rest of 1969, probably till September, October, I'd say. We showed a rough cut to the Beatles in June or July. So it was going to be their next release. And the film was pretty much put together by, say, October 1969, during which time the Beatles had not broken up, were together, made another album, weren't broken up, stayed together. So the Beatles were intact. However, near the end of 1969, call it maybe October or November, Apple, their company, the Beatles company, the Beatles, began to implode in a way. First of all, through financial issues, that the three of them wanted to go with one advisor. Paul McCartney didn't want to go with that guy. But as we know from great literature, what things which start about money often turn into have that other things are bubbling underneath, some kind of rancor, some kind of old history. So then the Beatles were breaking up at the end of 1969. None of them went to the premiere in London of this movie, which during which time they were all together. Then it gets released in America in May 1970, and they announced their breakup in April 1970. And people regard it as the breakup movie, that this tragedy that they were only imagining in their dreams, the breakup of the Beatles, had actually occurred, and we were seeing it now in Let It Be. But it wasn't the truth. That was a misapprehension. But because it wasn't helped by the Beatles, because they weren't sort of sanctioning it because they'd broken up and they were very upset and sad about that whole thing, it got a kind of bad rap. Peter Jackson sees it very clearly. He did an interview in America about 2 or 3 weeks ago with a guy called Anderson Cooper. And he walks very slowly through what happened to Let It Be and how it came to be seen as a bad Beatles movie because what was occurring in it was bad, but it was not the truth. So that's my rap.
Yeah, I mean, I know that Ringo said, you know, it's not a good movie because it's very depressing. But I've watched yours. I haven't. My life is too short to watch Peter Jackson's yet. And besides, I haven't got the Disney Plus thing. But I watched yours, and there's a great deal of joy in it. They're not having a bad time.
No, no, far from it. Now, don't forget, Ringo. See, Peter and I talk every so often. He said, you know, when he was doing Get Back with the Beatles, he had an entirely different ride than I did. For one thing, alas, two of them were dead, George and John. And Paul was 79, and Ringo was coming in on 80. And so the people he was dealing with were entirely different than the young men full of testosterone, talent and ambition, but also looking to find out what their next step was going to be. Those are the people that I was dealing with when we shot it originally. And I don't think, with respect, I mean, I have a lot of respect for him, Paul and Ringo. I don't think they've seen it for 50 years. And one of the things which is weird is that Paul kind of gets weepy about it and says, oh, you know, it's a very hard time and it's sort of depressing to look at, but I like it. I mean, he said to me he likes the movie. Sort of the same thing with Ringo. I doubt they've seen it for a long time. And I have a really good memory. I can't speak for other people's memories, but sometimes people conflate issues in the past and say, oh man, that was a real downer. That was
yeah,
a bad
yeah.
time.
No, exactly. Because because over the top of it is the sadness of, you know, John and George being dead and it's all over now and looking bad at our youth. But it doesn't mean it's a downer. It just means it's a, you know, really, really infectious documentary. You were so young as well. You were the same age as them. You're all in your, you know, 26, 27, 28, right?
There were 3 years between us all.
And you'd got to know them quite well because you'd done previous music videos with them. So yes. You weren't averse to telling them what to do and what you thought they should do, right?
Well, no, I had a very specific job, which was I thought to, insofar as I could, put choices up to them and say, well, it could be this, but maybe we should do that. Just in other words, Ringo had the idea to do it in the cavern. And I said, the cavern was a great spot, but I think you've outgrown the cavern. A, it was too small to shoot in. But that was then, we have to think of who you are now. And then someone else said, well, why don't we just do it very simply, do it in a field? And I thought, well, a field has got grass and trees, but it doesn't give us really anything else. And so I was trying to offer them choices about where we could do what began as a television special, an extravaganza, a concert, which then turned into a documentary. You had to be pretty alert in those days. But I think that was my job, was not to acquiesce to what they thought was right, unless I thought it was right, but to put up an opposition to them, because a lot of people in those days said yes to them because they were the Beatles.
They seemed very averse to you. One of your ideas was to go to Libya and shoot the concert in this amphitheatre. And in the Jackson documentary, I understand there are pictures of the said amphitheatre, and it's glorious, and it would have been fabulous. But they're strangely reluctant. Ringo doesn't want to go, and George is just over it, and they don't seem terribly adventurous or enthusiastic. That's what I will say about it. What do you think?
Well, there was a lot going on at the time. Ringo, in fact, if you see Peter's documentary, which even though it's long, it's got many rewards.
It's very long.
Well,
come on.
Yeah, but so is a flight from Australia to England.
Yeah.
Or New Zealand. Let me get
so
the right
So is
country.
Lord of the Rings. Anyway.
Okay. Now, Kim, quiet. So the thing is that when we were thinking of what to do, I had this idea of the amphitheater in Libya because I thought that what better place to bring the Beatles than the center of what had been the world, Mesopotamia, Africa, North Africa, the Mediterranean amphitheater, terrific. John Paul was with the idea, John was with the idea, and even John had decided, had suggested that we get a boat, which would take us, take the instruments, take the road crew, plus some fans, some audience, like 100 people, and part of our audience would be on the boat with us, and we'd all disembark in Libya together, and we'd do the show like that. And then also, if when you have a chance, this goes back to watching Peter's documentary, as I said earlier, you see Ringo, he and I in a close conversation, he agreed to, okay, if the others will do it, I will do it. He was very game. The only one who wasn't game was George, which then became the big issue in what was Let It Be, which was that George was going through, he was not in any way a villain, but he was going through some frustration. The frustration was based on the fact that John and Paul at that time were not really paying attention to George as a songwriter, not as a wonderful guitar player, but as a songwriter. And then when he plays them a song, which went on to be a great song, they think, oh yeah, well, that's nice. And then they went back to working on their own thing. So he was going through a period of frustration. The period of frustration had started when they all were teenagers. John was 16, Paul was 15, George was probably 13 when he joined the Beatles. And it solidified that relationship, older and younger. There's a story that the older two would sometimes walk along in the streets in Liverpool talking about their great plans, and George would be behind them carrying the guitar cases.
Oh, that's terrible.
And so then they weren't really giving him the time of day to do his own songs, which were important in several ways. One was financially, because the more songs he had in an album, the bigger the piece of the album he'd get. But also, in a much deeper and more profound way, was the artistic regard George would have for being, as it turned out, an absolutely wonderful songwriter. So he was vaguely pissed off anyway, which then led him a couple of days later to leave the group. And then, but the end of the little sequence we're talking about the amphitheater, which is a really very funny sequence in Wonderful Get Back. I convinced Ringo to go along. We talk about it. So I say at the end of it, which was going on all the time, so listen, are we all ready to go and do it in Libya? And then there's a kind of voice saying, yeah, okay, all right, yeah, sure. Oh, and then John Lennon says, yeah, but we can say yes tonight and no tomorrow.
We'll listen to that song that George plays in a moment, but tell me about the walkout. He just went, I'm out of here, did he?
Well,
because you didn't use that bit. Jackson uses that bit. You didn't.
I that's because Peter has the equipment. I didn't have the equipment. What happened was there's a sequence in Let It Be, which in Peter's one he uses in a slightly different way, where it seems, or people took it in 1970, that Paul and George are having a row. Paul says to him something like, you know, I hear myself like I'm always trying to get at you when I talk to you. And George says, well, I'll play what you want on this song or I won't play at all. Now, people have taken this like it was like a bomb going off. As you know, with all the people you've interviewed, and as I know, people, artists, people like talking about science, like you were talking about before I came on, have disagreements. The disagreements are not a bomb going off. They're just different ways of looking at things. Mm. And so when I put this in the movie, I didn't have a problem about that from the Beatles, which there were a few little problems about things they wanted in, things they didn't want in, because they recognized that the audience that they were looking for getting didn't see them as the Fab Four, as the Mop Tops anymore, would agree to acknowledge they actually were becoming different people. They were men now, they were 27, 28, they went 20, 21. And so there was this exchange between Paul and George, which people thought was like a bomb going off. As the morning was progressing, or as the next morning happened, the tension I could tell between them had not abated. It was festering, and so I bugged the flower pot at our lunch table because I didn't have cameras at lunches, at the lunch, which I should have done when I came up with the idea for The Roof. But I didn't think people would enjoy it, their meal, if there were cameras, you know, moving around and going on that, zooming into the plate and up to the face. So we didn't have cameras during the meal. So I thought something was going to go on. And so I bugged the flower pot. And that's when George came up and said, see you around the clubs. Meaning I'll see you in the nightclubs, but I'm not going to see you here anymore because I quit. Now, what Peter, as you know, has been working on this, I think, for 3 years. And he was given an extra year. And you have to actually get the realities, the dates from him. But he was given an extra year because of COVID and to finesse the picture and get it ready for release. And it went from being a 2-hour, 2.5-hour picture into what it is now, which is an 8-hour picture. But there were various shorter cuts. Anyway, during this time with Peter's a whiz at technology. During this time with AI, which I think is artificial intelligence, and just going back to science, I am not artificially intelligent, so I do not know about it. I'm from Earth, although I wish I did. So then anyway, while Peter's over there in Wellington or wherever he is that he works on this way of separating the tracks. So that in the old days, when I was doing Let It Be, if someone was noodling on a guitar, which guitar players do just by virtue of being a guitar player, noodle, 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 and they're talking, you can't separate, can't really hear what they're saying. Peter found this way to separate the tracks so he can drop the guitar down, lift the voice, you can hear what's being said. So there's a moment when George says, I think I'm going to go now. And someone says, what do you mean? He says, I think I'm going to go now and leave the band. That's roughly what he says. And so Peter has that on tape and also on film because he managed to get the voices right. Okay, so then George leaves the band for a week or so and everybody sort of sits around at the Daldrums wondering what we're going to do. And don't forget, until that moment, we're all planning on doing a concert, the Beatles extravaganza, the Beatles performing again to a public for the first time since 1966, when it all gotten too crazy and they stopped touring, stopped interacting with the public. So there's lots of conversations. They want George to come back. And then George says, I will come back, but there has to be no more talk about a television special, a concert. We have to leave the slightly acoustically challenged studio at Twickenham and go into our own studio in Savile Row at Apple. And so therefore, we're not going to do a show. And so what had started out as basically shooting a little documentary material of the Beatles rehearsing, which no one had ever seen before, as a sort of padding for the television special to be the great television special taking place in the center of the world with the whole world sitting in the amphitheater as it's midnight with torches flaming, turns into overnight pretty much a documentary. And then we all move to Apple, but we're not doing what we thought we were going to do in the first place, which leads us to some other stories. But yeah, so the answer is I don't have it in mind because I don't have the material the way Peter was able to have it in his because of separating the sound.
Right. I'm talking to some Michael Lindsay Hogg, who made the original documentary Let It Be, which has been expanded and scrubbed up and turned into a trilogy by Sir Peter Jackson. It's interesting when you look back, isn't it, Michael, because it seems like things were meant to be that way. But at the time, you must have thought, oh, damn it, OK, we're not going to Libya. We'll go up on the bloody roof and they're getting ready to go on the roof and it's too cold and maybe they won't go on the roof. And then they go on the roof and now the roof concert's one of the most famous concerts of all time just because... And it seems like that was the only thing that could ever, should ever have happened. Do you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, it actually was a little more complex than that. As we spoke, and we started off at Twickenham, which was a large soundstage in Twickenham, not surprisingly. And then after a week or 10 days, we moved to Apple. And again, going back to the way I saw my role as the director was to end up with something that we all thought was quite interesting and quite good. A, to give them choices, maybe not the cavern, maybe the amphitheater in Tunisia, but especially when we're at Apple, and Billy Preston joins us, not to do with Billy anyway, all they're doing is rehearsing and rehearsing and rehearsing and talking a little bit, which is what I was after, which is the conversations, but rehearsing, Let It Be, rehearsing, Get Back, rehearsing. And I didn't want the movie, which now was not a concert, was not a, in, taking place in Libya, but was a documentary, to just peter out with endless rehearsals. So I'm thinking, what do we need to make this go out with a bang? And then I thought, we were having lunch one day, and I said, you know, I think we need a conclusion for all this, what we've been doing. And then Yoko tripwired me by saying our conclusion's important. And I said, well, you know, they're not, you know, not only is she Yoko, but she's Lennon's girlfriend. So of course I have to be polite, which I would be anyway. And so I say, well, maybe conclusions are important, but maybe they're not, same in the art, but this time they are. And so I said, you know, we didn't do it at the cavern and we didn't go to Libya. So why don't we just do it on the roof? And then John says, do what on the roof? And I say a concert. And so that's how it happened, because the roof had to be shored up underneath with timbers because it wasn't strong enough to hold Billy Preston's organ. It always makes me laugh when I say Billy Preston's organ. And then the drum kit, and then the people up there. But also, it had to be figured out as much as possible for the guys with the mics and stuff like that. And plus which, if we were going to do it on the roof, we needed up on the roof six cameras. That's six camera operators, that's six focus pullers, that's 12 men to start with, let alone the camera opposite on the roof of the building opposite, three cameras in the road, plus the camera down in the lobby with the two-way glass on it so we can shoot the police if they're, like, it was quite a lot to technically do. And so we started to get ready for the concert, and you'll see in Peter's movie, one of the good bits, I mean, one of the many good bits, is, so I was saying to them, so we're going to do it on the roof tomorrow, are we? And then Paul says, well, you know, yeah, just, you know, you go and do what you're doing and we'll talk about it. And so I'm thinking, huh, you know, it's quite a lot of, I don't mean work, like, you know, I'm doing a lot of work. And so if I do the work and you don't want to do it, I
effort.
Okay, so then we go to the next day. And like you alluded to, we're standing underneath the roof, underneath the little wooden staircase, which goes to the roof around 12:30, because we want the lunchtime crowds. And I realize it's not secure, the Enterprise. Ringo says quite rightly, it's cold up there. And he's thinking of the guitar players, it's 43 degrees and windy about their fingering of their guitars. George says, what's the point? I mean, what are we doing? You know, why do we want to do a concert? We can't even see the audience, blah, blah. So Ringo is in the middle. George is no. And Paul says, come on, lads, we've got to do something, meaning we can't just sit in a studio for the rest of our lives. We have to find a way to connect again with the audience. But it's, and then Paul stops. And then no one says anything. And then there's silence. And then John Lennon says, fuck it, let's do it. And that, I mean, when John and Paul got together as a voice, that's what was going to happen. And so then they walked up the little staircase into history. We didn't know it was going to be their last concert. But the roof was not something that happened. You waved a magic wand and everybody turned up on the roof.
Did you not have a sense that it might be their last concert? I know that when you were trying to organize the show, you say, look, it's got to be great. It's got to be great. It might be the last TV show. So you got the sense that it was going to be the last something, right? What gave you that sense?
Well, it wasn't sure. I mean, it wasn't like I'm playing poker and I draw an ace. It wasn't that sure. It was like I drew a 10. But I'm thinking, who knows what's going to happen? Because we look back in the past month, which has occurred, George leaves, George comes back. they're not getting on the way they used to. And more interestingly, they're not writing together the way they used to write together, especially as teenagers, John and Paul, or when they're on the road. They have breakfast together. They can't go out of their hotel. There are too many fans. What are they going to do? They're going to write a song. They're not really writing together. They're not spending time with each other. They're not together in any real sense. So you think, well, I didn't think the Beatles would break up, but I certainly thought they would be making albums separately. I was sure George would make his own album. Paul went on to make his own album very quickly after the Beatles did break up, which I think was called Ram. John was quickly making his own, and then Ringo had some very successful albums. So I could see them making solo albums, but I thought they'd stay together just because, I don't know, because I was going through a sentimental patch in my late 20s. Why would the Beatles break up, who had been so instrumental in changing society? I mean, they knew what they'd done, but we knew more what they'd done because it was we, the people the Beatles had influenced, who were so much changed by them.
You talk about John and Paul still being the force, but not really being on the same page anymore. And I'm wondering how much the constant presence, the constant proximity of Yoko Ono was a cause in that.
Well, that's a very interesting question. It wasn't. It was like, it started off, I suppose, for the other three, like a bruise, like on their thumb or something like that, has made it hard for them. But after a while, the bruise didn't go away and they had to get on with their work. And so that's what happened. When I equate Yoko to a bruise, I just mean as something which was like an intrusive feeling she gave the others. Now, don't forget, the four of them, first of all, most of the famous musicians of that period who came out of England were children of the Second World War. Their parents, their uncles had been in the army for the most part. And then when they came out, they still were like soldiers. They had short hair, they had little mustaches, things like that. They were rationed in England. You couldn't get fabric for a nice new suit. You couldn't get more than two eggs a week. And also in Liverpool, they were North Country men. And in where they came from, the woman, the people like you, Kim, were relegated to looking after the children, making the meals, getting tea ready when the men came home from work, and basically just suffering in silence. That the men ruled the roost, although they didn't really. It was actually quite matriarchal. But the men seemed to rule the roost. And that's how the Beatles have grown up. Okay, the wife didn't come to work. It was as simple as that. So when John started to bring Yoko and wanted to be with her, the other three didn't know how to react, because also don't forget, they were not only from the north of England, tough, dour north of England, Liverpool, but they were rock and roll musicians. So how do they, who changed the world, changed hair, changed sexuality. So how do they deal with this? Well, they deal with it, I don't know what they were talking about privately, but they deal with it eventually by letting Yoko be there, not talking to John about it particularly, but just letting her be there. She didn't interfere with the songs. And they realized, I could tell you a story about that, they realized that John and Yoko had become inseparable and they were stuck because it wasn't going to change.
Inseparable, absolutely. They looked like they were joined at the hip.
Right, they were. Also, don't forget, you know, Yoko is seven years older than John. John and Paul both had, which I think linked them in a way, had the grievous misfortune of their mothers dying young, Paul when he was 12 and John when he was 16. And I think that it affected John, not that it wouldn't affect anyone, but I think it affected John because he's just getting to know his mother. He had a difficult, tricky childhood. And so Yoko became, as well as his companion, she became sort of like his mother too, because she would protect him. So sort of like, when, you know, like if they were having a meal break in their own and you wanted to talk to John, if they were sitting in a room and you'd go in, hello, Michael, how are you? He'd say, but then she'd say, oh, yes, what do you want? And then you talk to her and then she'd say, I think John would do that. Yeah, John, you want to do that? He'd say, all right. But you'd talk to Yoko first.
Was that irritating?
It was the way it was.
Was he fragile, John, at that point? I mean, his appearance had changed dramatically just before you started shooting this. I think he'd lost a lot of weight. I think he was on heroin at the time, and I don't know whether there was any sign of that.
Well, I'm, you know, my family is Irish, and so what we do on Saturday night is have a drink and not shoot up heroin. But
I'm not sure he ever shot it up, did he, Michael? I think he snorted it.
Sniff it. See, here's Kim, I'm not a drug person. I mean, one of the reasons I think I've got a good memory is I never took all the drugs. I mean, a lot of my friends did. I'm not knocking it. It's just I didn't. So he was supposed to be on heroin at the time, also because a lot of the time there was a guy in the circles in those days called Spanish Tony. And Spanish Tony was a nice, affable guy who was Keith Richards' pusher. And so you'd often see Spanish Tony around with Keith, and then he'd suddenly be turning up at the Let It Be rehearsals, and you were thinking, oh, well, that's, you know, John Heroin, stuff like that. Yeah, but your question was John fragile? And I think he was. I don't think he was as solid inside as Paul is. Paul is very self-sufficient. Paul has got there's a lot of different Pauls in there, and they all support him in ways he wants to be supported. I mean, he's got a voice like an angel, and he's one of the greatest songwriters of the past 100 years. John was a more fragile being, which is partly what caused him to react very quickly to provocation. Like when George quit the group, this was at the lunch, before George was out of the room, John said, let's get in Eric Clapton. He plays just as well, and he's not such a headache. Boom, like that. So John was like that. Paul was more measured in the way that he would deal with things. And I think John was the wise ass at school. Like he was the one who'd make the jokes, which the teacher would get annoyed with, but John would escape, you know. He was damaged in a way that Paul wasn't, and nor was Ringo. I mean, Ringo, as you probably know, spent most of his adolescence in hospital. He was very ill as a young boy.
What was wrong with him? I can't remember.
Oh, it started off with appendicitis, which became peritonitis, and then he got better than that. He's still in hospital, and then he gets tuberculosis.
Oh, yeah.
So Wingo was in hospital. I mean, I don't have the dates exactly because I wasn't there with him. I mean, he was in hospital from the time he's 12 to 16, pretty much. And so, but didn't turn. I mean, he's even though he doesn't like Let It Be, you know, screw him. But I like him because he's an extraordinarily resilient person. You know, I'm sorry these emails are coming in. I tried to turn them off. I think John was fragile. And so that is the answer to that question. Of all the four of them, he was a more fragile person, which is why when Yoko turned up, he needed her.
Just before this, you'd been working on the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus. Mm-hmm. And then the phone went and it was Paul McCartney and Let It Be started up. The Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus.
The Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus. And I just had my last meeting with the Beatles before Christmas. And I went back to where I was living with my girlfriend at the time. And I thought, wow, what could be better? The Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus and the Beatles concert. Boy, am I lucky. What happened with the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus is we have all these wonderful musicians on it, including John Lennon and Eric Clapton and The Who and the Rolling Stones and other people. The Rolling Stones, because they were the hosts, they get on stage at the end, which is 2 a.m. They worked till 5 a.m. They were exhausted because everyone had been there since noon. The Rolling Stones were the hosts. And who knows what they've been doing for 14 hours. I mean, they weren't a bunch of nuns. And so the Stones get on stage at 2. They work till 5 or 6. They're exhausted. Mick can hardly pull Sympathy for the Devil out one more performance, which he does, and it's great. Okay, then while I'm shooting Let It Be, I show a rough cut of the Rock and Roll Circus to Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, and Alan Klein, who's their manager as well as the Beatles manager. And at the end of it, they say, that's pretty good. But the Stones say, well, maybe we should reshoot our part. And I said, well, what's wrong with your part? And Keith Richards says, let's, if it were called the Who's Rock and Roll Circus, I wouldn't mind, but it's called the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, because they thought at the time the Who's performance was stronger and better than theirs. Okay. So then we don't reshoot it right away. The Rolling Stones go on tour. They come back. Then Mick does Ned Kelly. And then suddenly, like 9 months, a year has passed. And in those days, in the rock and roll world, there were lots of projects flying around all the time. And that sometimes something would be, that's what we're going to do. And then they sort of lose interest because a lot of things are coming their way. And so we didn't reshoot the Rolling Stones segment right away, partly because the set had been taken down. We didn't have a set anymore. We didn't have our tatty little European circus, which we designed. So then someone has the idea that we do it in the original circus, which is the Colosseum in Rome. I'm saying, you know, we do three quarters of the show in the little circus. You know, John Lennon performs there, the Who performs there. And then suddenly we go to the Colosseum in Rome for the Rolling Stones. I mean, what are we going to use as an audience? You know, lions? And so then whoever was trying to do it from the Rolling Stones side gets the balloon concession to the Colosseum, gets the popcorn concession for the Colosseum, but fails to get the permit from the city of Rome for the Colosseum. And so we don't do it. And then the whole thing gets put in the closet for 30 years. I mean, it is crazy. And then, of course, when the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus finally gets shown, it's at the New York Film Festival in 1996, 28 years after we'd shot it, where it's a special event where we get great reviews. And Keith was there. He said, why was this held up for so long? It's wonderful.
I want to ask you a personal question. And it came into my head when I read that you were constantly smoking big fat cigars in Peter Jackson's documentary. And you are, in a way, emulating Orson Welles, whom you worked with, but also whose son you thought you were for a while. Is that still a possibility to you?
Oh, that is, I mean, yes, Kim, thank you for screwing my brain around a little bit. Yeah, it is, it isn't. An agent asked me to write a book, a memoir, which I hadn't really wanted to do, but then I started to do it. And one of the things that I found as I was writing it was my mother, who I love very much, I think she loved me, was quite a complicated woman, and it was more complicated and complex than I had taken in as a young boy and as a young man. It started with when I was 16 and I was starting out working in the theater, and I thought Lindsay Hogg was a fairly unwieldy handle, as it for a name for an actor, which is I wanted to be. I had met Orson Welles the year before because he was directing and starring in King Lear that my mother was in. They always were very close. And so I went down to my mother one night after doing my homework, or actually not doing my homework, and I said to her, I've got an idea for my stage name. And she said, well, what's wrong with the name you've got? And I said, well, it's, you know, if you go into an agent's office and say, my name is Michael Lindsay Hogg, the secretary is going to say, what? And so I said, what about Michael Welles? And then my mother said, I'm not sure that's a good idea. And I said, why? And she said, well, I never told you this before because I didn't really think it mattered. But, you know, Orson and I were in a theater company, the Mercury, when we both were very young. Orson was younger. Orson was 24 and I was 25. And we were very close, she said. And some people think Orson is your father. And, you know, I'm 16. I think, that's interesting. And she said, but he's not. He's not, you know. And I said, what does Orson say about it? And she says, well, he's a problem because he never answers definitively. He'll say, oh, yeah, Michael, well, he could be. It works out time-wise. But I'd never do, you know, I knew Michael's father. I wouldn't do it like that. But, you know, I love Geraldine. We were very close. He never gives a definitive answer.
You only have 20. You only have 20 seconds to put us out of our suspense, Michael.
Basically, then my mother then reveals to one of her best friends, who's a wonderful woman who I went out with years ago, only 20 seconds, that Orson was my father, she said, but then I doubt that sometimes. So there it is, Kim. It's there. Is he? Isn't he? He may be. One of his daughters thinks he is. He was.
You'll just have to leave us with that ambiguity. It's very nice to talk to you, Michael Lindsay-Hogg.